Okay, thank you everyone for coming out to our Shavua Ton about dealing with after disaster reinvention in the life and career of Rabbi Akiva. And tonight we'll discuss one of the most significant transformations, reinventions that characterize Rabbi Akiva, and that's his reinvention in the area of education, both in his own education as a student and as a teacher. So we'll look, Rabbi Akiva's life was really, building and then encountering challenges, and we'll see what ways he reinvented, what types of issues he was responding to, and eventually how it all came together and really what his legacy was, both as a student and as a teacher. Everyone can see me?
Yes.
I'm just gonna. Okay, excellent. So, just meeting some people in the waiting room. Okay, so, Rabbi Akiva, as a student, at the beginning of his career as a student, really had to break into the system as an outsider. And both on an economic and on an intellectual level. We'll see, he was, Dr. Schreiner mentioned last night a little background about Rabbi Akiva. He was a shepherd, he was in one of the lower working classes of society, and was ignorant. We'll see, maybe he knew something, but he was certainly not in a scholarly class, and he had to break into that world. And there are basically two accounts of Rabbi Akiva's early life. One in the Gemara in Ksuvos, one in Nedarim, similar Gemaras, and in Avos de Rabbi Nasan, Midrashim on Pirkei Avos. And one describes his beginning as his desire to go learn and his beginning as a student with the encouragement of his wife, that it was a condition that his wife would accept marriage if he went to learn. And another one describes an experience that Rabbi Akiva had, which encouraged him to learn and gave him confidence that he could also accomplish. So we'll take a look at these different beginnings of Rabbi Akiva's career, and you can see that they're telling us something about him and arguably about the society in which he lived. So the one account of Rabbi Akiva's beginning as a student was that he was a shepherd of Ben Kalba Savua. Kalba Savua, the name comes as being a satiated dog that Gemara says that people would come to people who are in need, would come to him, and he would give them everything they need and they'd be completely satiated. I don't know if it's a great name for a restaurant, but that's the said that people, they came hungry and they left like a satiated dog. And he was one of the wealthy residents of Jerusalem. And apparently he had displayed some positive or sincere characteristics, that he was humble and refined. And Kalba Savua's daughter noticed him. And she took a liking to him, but they were of different social economic classes. But she realized his qualities, and she agreed to marry him, or proposed they would be married on condition that he would go and study. And her father, it's interesting, as charitable as he apparently was, wouldn't have someone of this lower class marrying into his family. And he's very upset by it. They married in secret, and Kalba Savua kicked his daughter out of the house and took a vow prohibiting any benefit from his possessions or from his property. So just with this first account of Rabbi Akiva at least trying to break into the system of learning, what is this telling us about the society? Is it portraying it in a particularly favorable way? Is it critical? How do you understand it? So, I in a book I have by professor, Jeffrey Rubinstein. He's a professor at NYU. And he pointed out that a lot of these, this story and similar stories in the Talmud are implicit criticisms of the classism that existed at the time, particularly between the intellectual elite and the commoner. He actually says that with the story of Hillel, who was so poor, he couldn't afford the entrance fee to the yeshiva, so he would go on the roof, and then eventually the rabbis inside noticed him, and he was frozen. They took him in. But he says, what does that tell us about a system where there was, in that story, where there was a guard at the door, where the poor weren't allowed in? And perhaps this could also apply to our stories. You see, to someone who is Kalba Savua, he was in the higher class of society, and he was apparently very generous. But when it came to someone entering his family, and from what we understand about Rabbi Akiva, that his standing and his position as a shepherd was something that really...
It was beneath him.
I'm sorry?
It was beneath him.
Right. It was considered beneath him for him to enter the family. And that, see, Rabbi Akiva, the next verse of the Rabbi Nelson, says explicitly that Rabbi Akiva was ignorant. He didn't know anything. And it seems that this was because of his, largely due to his position as a shepherd, is that people in that position, at least beyond a certain level, we'll see, maybe Rabbi Akiva had somewhat of an education, but beyond a certain level, this class of people didn't have access to Torah learning, and they were even excluded. And we'll see, perhaps this is setting the stage, because Rabbi Akiva in his career will seem take some steps to perhaps rectify this problem.
Rabbi?
Yep.
I hear what you're saying, and I heard it, I guess, the other day as well. But reading this, her father became angry when he heard, I think, when he heard that she betrothed him privately.
So you're saying that it's an interesting point, that it sounds like he became angry when after it mentions that they became betrothed in secret. So I think that could be, may have taken it as an additional slight, but from the fact that they were betrothed in secret, it seems to be because she knew that her father wouldn't approve. You know, if he's the wealthiest guy in town, so presumably they'd, you know, in non-COVID times, they'd have a lot of guests. It would be a big production. But presumably she knew that her father wouldn't approve, and they were betrothed in secret.
But it speaks well of her because she saw his good qualities.
Oh, it definitely speaks well of her that she was able to recognize his good qualities even before he was learned. Right. It's a tremendous praise of her. And we'll see that she is responsible for Rabbi Akiva's success in learning. But it's Rabbi, a pretty, so it shows that there were differences in approach, but there may have been this barrier between those who had means and those who had means who were able to advance more in learning, and those who didn't, who were, you know, unfortunately, basically ignorant. They didn't have access to Torah in that way.
Rabbi?
Yes.
But we also see that when King David was a shepherd, he wrote a lot of his psalms, so a lot of scholarship came as a shepherd. This is like an awesome.
Right, so as a shepherd, right, a shepherd is, considered a positive type of career. It may not make someone wealthy, but we do see different shepherds. Moshe's shepherd, that shepherds, the Avot described it as shepherds. So shepherds is a career that's considered praiseworthy. But at least as far as his means, he was not someone of means, and apparently didn't have the education that put him in the standing or in the running to marry someone like Kaba Savua's daughter.
But he had more time to be moving up, because that's what we see with King David. He was studying and writing.
I don't know.
The songs and everything. He was moving up at being a shepherd.
Right. Well, he had... it didn't. Eventually, we'll see in source number two, and that was there would be no son. The fact that he was a shepherd, maybe it made it more flexible for him to take. I don't know if it was a paid leave of absence. It probably wasn't a paid leave of absence, but he was able to then. He was inspired. He saw something that inspired him, and he was able to then go and learn. And this describes Rabbi Akiva's origins a little bit differently. And it's unclear which happened first. It could be that the first one happened first, and this was something that then gave him encouragement all the way. But it tells a story, famous story, about that Rabbi Akiva was 40 years old, and he hadn't learned anything, and he was standing by a well. And he remarked, who carved a hole in the stone? And they said that this happened because water day after day falls on it, and little by little it makes a hole in the rock. And they said it says avanim shakaku mayim. They quoted a verse from Eo from the book of Job. They said, don't you know this, that water erodes stones? So he applied this to his situation. He said, if something soft like water can carve something hard, so all the more so the words of Torah, which are compared to steel or iron, can engrave themselves in my heart. So then, based on that encouragement, that lesson, it says that he immediately began to study, and he started with, Aleph Bet Gimel Dalet Hey. So it sounds like he really started with the rudimentary curriculum. So just an interesting note, which some of the commentaries on this passage pick up, is apparently he was able to recognize a verse from the book of Eov. So evidently he had some sort of education. So what does it mean when he said that he then had to learn the alphabet? So in source number three, the Binyan Yehoshua, one of the commentaries on Avos Rebbe Nosson, said that, yeah, evidently he had somewhat of a knowledge of Tanakh, but when it said then he went back to school to learn the alphabet, so it was in the manner that the following passage in the Talmud in Shabbos tells us. And in source number four, there was a certain method that children were taught the alphabet. So they were taught as follows, just a fun way, maybe teachers can apply this. So it says, Aleph Bet means Aleph, learning Bina, learning the wisdom of the Torah. Gimel Dalet means Gemol Dalim, to give to the poor. It is, why is the Gimel extended toward the Dalet? Because it's a matter of one who bestows loving kindness to go after, to run after the poor. So it could be that Rabbi Akiva, when it says they learned the alphabet, it may be that this was the beginning of his career studying on a serious level, but it's possible that he did know something. He wasn't totally illiterate. But that supports what we suggested before, that maybe those who were the shepherds, those in that class, had very basic education, but certainly weren't able to pursue beyond the basics. And we see then that Rabbi Akiva went on. He was a thirsty student, and that's the basis of this passage in commenting on the statement in Pirkei Avos, Rabbi Shosef et Sama es Dibrehem, that you drink thirstily of the words of the sages. And we see that Rabbi Akiva definitely did that, that he went to the yeshiva of Rabbi Elezer and Rabbi Yehoshua. And he said he progressed with, once he learned the Tanakh, so then he said, teach Mishnah for me. They taught him one law and said that he would go and contemplate it and make sure he understood it. And then he kept coming back and he kept on asking questions. And he would say, this Aleph, what's it written for? This bet, this letter, this law, what does it mean? And it shows, as a student in the process of reinvention, it shows you can't be too shy about asking questions. You could say, what's he doing? He's asking, and the student, he has to ask, oh, this list letter, why is it written like this? What exactly does this mean? We're told elsewhere, the Gemara Menachos says that Rabbi Akiva would be able to interpret the Torah from the crowns above the letters. So you see from his questions, from his thirst for knowledge, he was able to pursue, he was able to grow. And just the lesson about that someone who is about a student, that we shouldn't be afraid to ask questions. As a teacher, we should be willing to answer students' questions, because as we see with Rabbi Akiva, he was able to grow and understand Torah on an even greater level than they were. And it compares that he was able to, you know, to uproot mountains. That is, his understanding of Torah went beyond really any of the other sages of that generation. But back to the point about the gap between the haves and the have-nots as far as their access to Torah. So it seems like Rabbi Akiva made some improvements in that way. And he really went based on the statement in Pirkei Avos, V'amidu tamidim harbin, quote in source number 7, that you should raise up many students. And this is telling us that both as far as the abilities, the character of the students, and probably also their social standing and economic condition, that there's a value in adding students. We should have many students. We shouldn't be exclusive. And this commentary in Pirkei Avos, Obadiah and Bartanura, said that this is coming to show us that our approach should not be like that of Rabban Gamliel. We're told in the Gemara in Brachos that Rabban Gamliel had a very exclusive admissions policy, that he wouldn't accept anyone whose outside didn't match his inside. And because of that, he had relatively few students. But then Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, a younger man took over. So then he opened up, and this statement is meant to tell us that Torah study shouldn't be exclusive. It shouldn't be exclusive based on the character or the seeming character of the students or their abilities, but should be open to everyone. And we see that Rabbi Akiva, just as far as the number of students that he amassed, that after source number 8 is the continuation of the first source we saw, that when Rabbi Akiva's wife sent him off to learn. So source number 8, the Gemara Ksuba says that after he went and sat and learned for 12 years in the yeshiva, and when he returned, he brought back 12,000 students with him. So presumably if there are 12,000 students, so that's a tremendous amount. So it sounds like he was, in his career as a teacher, he was making Torah more accessible. He was allowing more students to join his yeshiva, to become his followers, and seems to be addressing the system that initially excluded him. We'll see there may be some pitfalls of this approach, but let alone having a small yeshiva, but 12,000 students. Then he returned with the permission of his wife for another 12 years and amassed another 12,000 students. So at that point, he had 24,000 students. And at this point, he became a great person. His wife gave him permission, and he was criticized, that people would taunt his wife. There's a man would taunt his wife, saying, "How long will your husband leave you living like a widow?" He was poor. They didn't have money. And she said, if it were up to her, he would go and learn for another 12 years. So he went and did that. And again, we see that the Gemara tells us that they were coming back. She heard that Rabbi Akiva, her husband, and his students were coming to town. And she didn't have nice clothing. She didn't look like a wealthy woman. And she fell on her face to greet him. And Rabbi Akiva's students, you know, his gabayim, his gatekeepers, pushed her away. And he tells them the famous, very true line for anyone who's married, "Shelivah shalchem shalahu," that what's mine and what's yours belongs to her. That was because of her self-sacrifice, she allowed me to go and learn, and that's why I was able to become who I am, and that's how I'm able to teach you. But again, we see that this system and this attitude still remained. And this says something about of the character of his students, that they came with him, and they were students who were presumably immersed in Torah around the clock. But when they saw someone who they thought wasn't of their standing, maybe didn't think should be there, so they tried to push her aside, and he had to correct that.
Rabbi, what is yours? What does he mean? What is yours?
Meaning that which I've given you, meaning the Torah which I've given you. What's mine, what I've acquired, what I've learned, and what's yours, what I've given you, belongs to her, meaning she's responsible for it.
Thank you.
All right. And then we see that her father hears that a great man came to town, and he was thinking maybe he'll annul the vow that he made. And it could be because the annulment of vows is a complicated area. So if the scholar was coming to town, so perhaps he had some regrets about what he did, and he was interested in nullifying it.
But why did he want to nullify it?
So it's unclear because at this point he doesn't it's not revealed yet that this is Rabbi Akiva. He hears that a great man is coming to town. He doesn't know it's Rabbi Akiva. Presumably, it's because maybe he had some regrets in general, and presumably it's because this person who was a scholar who knew all the ins and outs of that area of halacha, of the laws of vows, maybe then he would be able to use that opportunity to see if he could nullify the vow. It's like if someone has a big question and they know a big scholar is coming to town, so they'll use that opportunity to ask the questions. So Rabbi Akiva, who I felt like wasn't evident right away that it was him. So he said, did you vow thinking that this person would become a great man? And he says, if I would have known that he would, that if he even knew one chapter, one halacha, I wouldn't have been so harsh. I wouldn't have made this vow, restricting all of my possessions to my daughter and to him. And Rabbi Akiva reveals to him, I'm that person. I'm the person who you disowned, who you thought was such an ignoramus, who was it, who you weren't going to allow into your family. And Kabbal Sevua realized his error, fell on his face, kissed his feet, and gave him half of his possessions. And yesterday, those who were here, I got to hear from Rabbi Tertunio a little bit about Rabbi Akiva's wealth and his economic approach. So there's a comment of Tosfos on this Gemara, which I learned a couple of years ago, and it's really a technical legal point, but it's something that is always very inspiring to me. And that's the following. Rabbi Akiva asked Kabbal Sevua, did you vow thinking that he would become a great man? And Kabbal Sevua says, you know, had he even known one halacha, one chapter, I wouldn't have made this vow. But Tosfos have a problem here. They say, "Halo aser l'tach b'nolad," isn't it forbidden to revoke a vow based on a circumstance that developed later on? Meaning when we annul a vow, and there are many details to it, but the general idea is that we're able to annul the vow because we understand there was a certain condition that it's something that existed at the time that a person didn't realize that this vow would impact them in that way. So you could say, you know, had I known about this factor, I wouldn't have made this vow. Or maybe I was under duress, or I was in in a difficult situation. But had I known something, I wouldn't have annulled the vow. But if you say that if the case is that you made the vow and the situation that existed at the time, the vow was in your interest, but then something else happened afterwards that made this vow undesirable. The example the Gemara gives, you say, I won't, benefit from another person, and then he becomes a sofer, becomes a scribe, and you want to buy something from him. So you can't do that. It's an ein poskin benolad. You can't release a vow based on a situation that develops later on. So yes, how could Rabbi Akiva null Kalva Segula's vow? But at the, he said he made the vow with the understanding that he didn't know one halacha, that he didn't know one chapter. It's not that he said that, oh, I didn't realize that he knew this, or I didn't realize this existed at the time. He said, had I known that he would go on to, at the time, if he even knew that, so I wouldn't have made the vow. But the point is, he didn't know it at the time. So Tosfos answer that this isn't considered a situation that developed later on, the fact that Rabbi Akiva went from an ignoramus to the greatest Torah scholar. Rather, they say that anyone who goes to the yeshiva, so it's expected that it's expected that they'll become a Adam Gadol, a great person. So it just that tells us something about learning, that we're given a guarantee. We're not even saying that if we go to commit ourselves to learning in whatever capacity, we may accomplish, we may not. This is saying at the time that Rabbi Akiva and his wife entered the marriage, so the condition was that he would go to the yeshiva. It says once he was committed to going to the yeshiva, then it would be expected that obviously he would learn something. Obviously, he would be on a path to develop into a great person. So it just shows. And if Rabbi Akiva was using this rationale, he understood that when someone commits to learning, that is a reason to basically consider as if they've already accomplished something. So that's really his reinvention as a student and as an educator. As a student that he had to break into a higher class economically and intellectually, and as an educator, one of the developments that he made was having more students. And here we see also realizing the potential of someone who comes to start learning and teaches with that understanding. But the most significant reinvention of Rabbi Akiva, very relevant to Lag BaOmer, is what happens after, unfortunately, his 24,000 students perished. Rabbi Akiva says that if one studied Torah in his youth, he should study more Torah in his old age. You see this very consistent with his approach as a student, that there's always more to learn. And if someone is students in his youth, he should have additional students in his old age. That in the morning, she'll sew. And so you're seeing in the evening, don't withhold your hand. And this is a saying that you never know what's going to happen. So you always have to keep on learning, always have to keep on teaching. And how did this apply to Rabbi Akiva? Say that Rabbi Akiva had 12,000 pairs of students, 24,000 students total, who spanning the country, and they all died in one period of time. More later on, they all died between Pesach and Atzeres, between Pesach and Shavuos. Why did they die? Why did this plague strike them? Because they didn't lenagu kavod zeh lazeh, that they didn't conduct themselves in a manner of honor, with the proper type of respect. So what may be the reason for this? Rabbi Akiva, he was apparently an extraordinary educator. All the students flocked towards him. And so why was it that all of his students didn't act with each other, towards each other, with the proper respect? So if we look at the way that he reinvents, we may find the answer. Because how many students does he pick up afterwards, after the plague ended, and he then fulfilled his teaching that if you that even in your older age you should raise up students. So in verse number 12, said that after this plague, the world was basically desolate of Torah until he came to the south and started teaching five students, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Huda, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon, and Rabbi Lazar ben Shemua. It says these are the ones who upheld the study of Torah at the time. So that was showed his teaching that maybe your first labors won't be productive, won't endure. But then the second time around, if you keep on trying and you don't stop, then you'll have disciples that will that will endure and will carry on the tradition. But what's different about the way he taught, or the at least the number of students between his first part of career and after the plague? So I'd say one thing, there's a big difference between 24,000 and five. Right? Really, Rabbi Akiva had a reputation. And after this, Rabbi Akiva, you know, opened up a yeshiva. So you could probably get more people who wanted to enroll.
They also knew how to behave.
I'm sorry?
They also knew how to conduct themselves with each other.
Right. It was clear that then they learned that message. But I suggest that after the Rabbi Akiva's first group of students perished because they didn't act with each other with the proper respect, maybe Rabbi Akiva realized that it's very hard to have an impact on so many people. And maybe 24,000 was too much. 24,000 people will sit in your class, but you can have a connection with all of them? Are you being able to transmit the values that you want to all of them? So it seems like Rabbi Akiva, as great as he was, as great as his shiurim was, he wasn't able to transmit the values that he has to his students. And it's probably because on a practical level, it was too many.
It's
a big difference.
Whose fault was it?
24,000 and five.
Right.
Maybe 100.
Yeah, Moish.
Yeah.
You're on mute.
I do not believe for one second that there was a problem with kavod, of real kavod in Rabbi Akiva's students. That was a cover given for the fact that the students were killed, for the most part, one way or the other, supporting Bar Kokhba's army. The reason they used not a lot of kavod was that everybody knew that could not possibly have happened with Rabbi Akiva's students. They could not give proper kavod to the loss because the Romans went on a murderous binge of killing everybody, especially Talmidim. They had to come up with something that would simply be a cover that everybody would know this is not true. They died one way or the other.
Right, the Gemara and Yevamo say they died of Ascaras, a sort of disease.
No, they died. They were fighting in Bar Kokhba's army, fighting, supplying, spying, whatever you want to call it. They were a very large part. And the reason the Romans went nuts was that the deal Rabbi Yochanan had made with the Romans was he could go to Yavne, but his students could not fight. It would be understood that they could not fight. And when this happened and the Romans saw what the students had done to them, that's why they went crazy about Talmud Torah.
Could be. It could be that these other conditions were impacted on this. I mean, I think your point is very valid. Is in general, the rabbis and our sages do emphasize a certain aspect of an event. To me, the event is more than what's described, but they'll emphasize a certain aspect to relay a certain message. But in most events that it describes, there's more to it. So that could be to emphasize the lesson from it, but the historical details aren't all there. It's a very brief passage. But I think it's evident that Rabbi Akiva changed his approach. In his reinvention as an educator, he changed his approach from one who it was basically doors wide open to everyone to someone who realized this, that there was a capacity, a limited capacity for an ability to connect with people, to impact. And that's why he really needed to start with five, but really focus on a few individuals. And by doing so, because he said earlier that wasn't Rabbi Akiva an example of someone who was making improvements to the system of not excluding people from Torah, not making it just for the elite. So I think what Rabbi Akiva did in his reinvention as an educator after the disaster was he himself taught a small number of students, but by giving them the attention that they needed, they went on to be tremendously influential teachers of others. So in that way, he was able to give everyone the proper attention, but also develop students who could go out and teach others. So the sum total of students was greater. And the Gemara in Sanhedrin, source number 13, tells us just how impactful these students are. That we have a principal, Stam Mishnah Rebbe Meir. We have a Mishnah, and we don't have, the Mishnah doesn't cite the author. So we assume it was authored by Rebbe Meir. The Rebbe Meir was the prominent author, redactor of the Mishnayot. Yeah. The Tosefta in Nehemiah, not one of his students, Sifra, the Halachic Medrash, like Rabbi Yehuda, Sifri, the Halachic Medrash on Vayikra, like Rabbi Shimon, and Kulo Oliva, the Rabbi Akiva. The Rabbi Akiva was basically the source of all of this. He taught his students these essential areas of Torah, and they became the primary teachers of those areas, but it started with Rabbi Akiva. So in contrast to his first time around, where he spread Torah through teaching the largest amount of students, he reevaluated that approach. And the second time, he instead paid attention to a small group of students who then went out and were able to impact others in a tremendous way.
Does that mean that he agreed with Rabban Ganuya?
So I think the answer could be that he disagreed in principle. He agreed with the principle that you should have Talmidim Harba, that you should have many students, and that we shouldn't exclude students. But I think what he did the second time around is he realized that one teacher has a limited capacity. Or really anyone who's taught, or anyone who's a rabbi, knows there's different people have different ways of connecting, but there are only so many people who you can connect with on such a personal level in such an impactful way. And that's why a teacher has to develop students to go and spread Torah, or has to have other teachers. So I think in principle, he maintained the value that Torah should be open to everyone. It shouldn't be limited. It shouldn't be only for the elite, but there's a way to do it. There's a way to reach people. You have to start out small, and then those people can go and impact the rest of the world.
Maybe he adopted the few that he felt were on a special level and kind of, I don't want to use the word cultivated. He taught them more, had a relationship with them stronger than the whole class.
Right. Right, that could be, and that in his, it seems like this wasn't an official yeshiva. This is more a private study with him. So that could be that it could be that he wanted to develop leaders, and not everyone can necessarily be a leader. So he wanted to develop those leaders. But I would think just based on his background, based on his values, that he didn't have the approach. It could be that maybe he had an approach more similar to that. He realized that if you have 24,000, then maybe some of them, you have to really question their character. But I think we could still say that he valued teaching the masses, but he thought the best way to do it was to develop leaders. And true, it could be that those leaders, that he picked people who were particularly qualified as leaders.
Rabbi, is it fair to say that he set them up for failure and then maybe some of the fault of how they behave was him. And is that a lesson to him too, other than just changing to a smaller number?
That he may have been overly ambitious to take on so many students.
Does he show any regret that so high? If she was so high in education, he should have understood. Does he take any responsibility for what happened to them?
I'm not aware of as an expression of regret, but we don't see that. Then he went and tried to get the thousands more. You see, then his approach was just very different. Because in the first time around, we're told, it seems very quick. He went to yeshiva, then after 12 years, he came back with 12,000. The next 12 years, he came back with another 12,000. So it seemed like the first time around, he was really just taking on as many students as he could. Where the second time, he didn't go with that approach.
He doesn't show any regret that this happened because of a failure on his part?
I'm not aware of a place where he expresses that. I'm not aware, but it's a very good point that you would think he would. Maybe he doesn't record that.
The teaching method must have been different, because to have 24,000 Talmidim, you can't devote much time to them. So maybe they were taught in some sort of militaristic way, in terms of the organization, by cohorts and divisions and... So you have the Rebbe teaching,
right? That could be, but I think ultimately he was the leader. He was the Rebbe, so it was his responsibility and his role to guide them both in the Torah knowledge and in the values. So it could have been that the first time around there's more of an emphasis on the content, on the knowledge, on the scholarship, but not necessarily on the development. Because you said, how can someone focus so closely on so many students?
Is that some kind of a self-pride that allowed him to say, oh, look, I have so many and so many. That means I'm so great. But at the same time, he didn't do what he should have been doing.
So it could be that, because it seems to have gone hand in hand with his development in his own learning. He progressed very quickly in an extraordinary way. But then as he did, so he got more and more students. Basically, it's like 1,000 students every year. So it could be that, I don't want to say a naivete, but maybe a certain optimism that he now that he was progressing, he was accomplishing, so he wanted to give everyone the opportunity to come and learn. But and maybe it was, he did feel that he had a greater ability than he did to impact a large amount of people. But it could have been something that was a result of a lack of experience. So it's definitely when he had more experience and when he realized the limits of what you can do with so many students. So then clearly he did reevaluate the approach, and maybe that was also a development in humility and perspective. But as far as if they ask the question of that arrogance, we don't see any indication about that. In fact, the Gemara says that Kalba Sivua's daughter noticed him because of his humility. But again, it may have been the experience. The more you do things, the more you realize what works and what doesn't. So I think that may explain it. And if anyone has a source sheet that I recommend reading Rabbi Turchiner's beautiful drasha from several years ago about the death of Rabbi Akiva's students, and focuses on the fact that those who transmit Torah have to be of pristine character. And we see that's why the first set of students really didn't merit to be the ones who transmitted the tradition, because Torah has to be transmitted by people who are of a high character. And the second time around, we see through different statements throughout the Talmud that the second set of students did absorb the values that Rabbi Akiva did. And we'll look at some of those statements in Rabbi Turchiner's Dvar Torah, source number 14, he quotes others as well. The question in the chat, it could be that he was so absorbed in the teaching that he was oblivious to everything else. That could be. That could be. Sometimes, when you teach Torah, you're very engrossed in the topic and maybe do lose sight of of how the students are understanding it and what they're gaining from it. I think it was Shlomo Hyman, the Rosh Yeshiva at Torah Vidas. Don't remember, maybe him, but who had the line, you know, I don't teach Torah, I teach Talmidim, which is a very important lesson for anyone who teaches, that there's a teaching of the content, but that's not the primary thing. You teach your students, you develop your students into Torah personalities. So that could be. It could be that the first time around that he was more focused on the content. The second time around, he was focused on the Talmidim, on the students. And we see in the second time around, it seems like the students of Rabbi Akiva, the five students, did absorb the general lesson of acting with each other with honor. And the Gemara doesn't say exactly how they didn't, but whatever deficiencies in honor there were, it seems like the second pair of students were able to rectify that behavior. So, for example, Rabbi Meir in Pirkei Avos demonstrates the proper respect for other people who learn Torah. That apparently among the students of Rabbi Akiva, among colleagues who learned Torah, there wasn't a sufficient respect and reverence. But Rabbi Meir speaks about the type of reverence and love that one should have for someone else who learns Torah. Rabbi Meir says in number 15, so that's called Oev Makom, Oev Brios, that he's loved by other people. He's a lover of humanity. And this is the kind of respect that Torah scholars should have among one another. But this is the type of personality that learning Torah should create. That's someone who loves people, someone who represents Hashem in a positive way, and who makes Hashem beloved, and that's something that Rabbi Meir taught, and is something that is in contrast to the idea of not acting with others towards honor. This it's the contrary. Rabbi Huda Bar Eloi, the Gemara in Sanhedrin in number 16. Says that in the generation of Rabbi Huda Bar Eloi, that it was they're very impoverished, and that six of his students would cover themselves with one garment. They would share a blanket. They had limited resources, but they would cover themselves in one garment, and they would study in Torah. They would study Torah despite the hardships. So you see that they shared what little they had, and they were committed to their communal goal of studying Torah. And that's why the Gemara there uses the pasuk Yiras Hashem Hisitzalo, that who fears Hashem should be praised. That it says that there's even greater than this attribute of learning Torah in hardship and sharing what little one has with someone else is even greater than the Gemara says in the generation of Moshe and the generation of Chizkiyahu, that this is something, this is behavior that exemplifies what the Torah should accomplish. We have Rabbi Yossi, who I think his teaching in the following Gemara in Brachos displays the value of sensitivity and patience. That he said that you shouldn't try to placate a person while he's in the throes of anger, and you should be patient. And this shows, you know, sometimes you want to, you know, when I calm someone down, you want to help them, you think you're doing good, and it can be a little bit of a, it can be a little bit of a threat to your ego to say, oh, this person doesn't want to hear from me now. But that's something that Rabbi Yossi taught, is that you want to help a person, you want to really respect them, show them honor. So when they're ready to be calmed down, when they're ready to talk, that's when you should be there. You shouldn't just be there when you want to be there, when you want to be of help. You should be there at a time when they want and when you can most effectively benefit them. I'm frozen. Am I still frozen? Am I frozen or am I here? Oh, I got kicked out of my
ear. We can hear you now. That's better.
Okay, sorry about that. I guess I didn't. Only problem is now I'm unfortunately not the host, so I can't share the screen. But if you'll, I apologize.
That's
for
okay.
That. But let me. I'll put the source sheet link to the source sheet in the chat, and you can follow along that way.
Good.
But it's technical difficulties that sometimes do occur. So just saying in the last part, that's exactly where I got cut off, but the teaching of one of his students, Rabbi Yossi, who emphasized the idea of sensitivity and patience. So when you want to calm someone down, you want to help them with their problems, so you should do it when they're ready to. You should do it at their own comfort and not just do it when you want to. And you know, that's a real way that when you want to help someone, that you show them honor. And source number 18 was on the last page, for those who just opened it, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, one of Rabbi Kiva's students, says that it's preferable for a person to go into a kivshan ha'esh, to go into a fiery furnace, than not to whiten the face of his friend in public, meaning whiten the face, not to embarrass his friend in public. So this also demonstrates the value of showing honor to one another, that it's better to sacrifice everything else. And certainly, to sacrifice one's own advancement. It could be that amongst students, there's competition, there's a desire to advance, but they say sacrifice anything else, even to throw yourself into a fiery furnace rather than to embarrass someone else, let alone just in general, you're not giving proper honor to one another. And then number 19, the fifth of Rabbi Kiva's students, Lazar ben Shemua, said, that you're the honor of your student shall be as dear to you as your own, and the honor of your colleague as the reverence for your teacher, someone who's equal to you, should be like someone who's even greater than you. Your teacher should be like the fear of heaven. So even if someone is your colleague, even if someone is on the same level, so you should view them as a teacher and have the proper honor for them. And it seems like there are other quotes from these five students of Rabbi Kiva. Some of them are in the article linked from Rabbi Tershiner, but these all show that in one way or another, these students who were so influential were able to, had inculcated the message and taught the message of always being careful to show proper honor to one another. And the final way that we see